Welcome to Take It From Us with host Kent Johns. Real people, real voices, real lives. Discussing mental health, addiction and disability in the community. Your weekly window to the real world. Welcome to Take It From Us.
Our guest on Take It From Us today has described the desire to use methamphetamine as stronger than the desire to live. More than 15 years on from his last puff of pee, Kevin Hollingsworth is now a fully registered clinical practitioner and addiction counsellor. He's based in Rotorua and serves as the executive director for the Mana Enhancing Stop Group. In the words of that organisation, recovery doesn't happen in people, it happens between people. Kevin has been to some dark places, including prison. Now he's a positive driving force for good. But how has he been able to turn his life around, and what is his message of hope he's giving to others who are struggling in life just as he used to? Let's find out. Here is Kevin Hollingsworth's story on Take It From Us. Hey, Kevin, it's really great of you to join us on our program. How are you?
Kia ora, I'm excellent. Moi ho tanga, awesome.
Awesome. All right. You'll give us plenty of your time today, and we really appreciate that. How are you managing your time these days, given how busy you are?
Yeah, that's always a big question between study, mahi, and I wear a couple of different hats, so ensuring that, you know, it's like spinning plates, you know, it's about making sure that I'm giving enough wind for those plates to start spinning, and the ones that are less time, so I just need to have that balance. Yeah, getting that balance right, Ken. Yeah, definitely.
Love the spinning plates metaphor. I use it myself too. Do you find that you have to stop and put plates down, or do they actually fall and smash?
Yes, they used to fall and smash, but now I have enough sort of tools to actually put them down and actually say no. I'm one of those people who say yes to a lot, because coming from my own journey, I never wanted to disappoint people. So I'm one of those yes people. But now I have a loving partner who keeps me in balance and says to me, you might need to think about other things. So kia ora.
Well, there's that phrase that I like, which is, hey, if you want something done, you ask a busy person. But I also know that people that say yes to everything are often people pleasers, and they are the ones that are often at risk of burnout. So are you able to make sure that you're okay?
Yeah. That's a big thing, especially in the industry that I work in the mental health and addiction. It is prevalent to burnout, stress. So one of the things that you often get asked for, how do you manage stress and how do you manage self-care? So for me, self-care is get enough sleep, try to get enough kai, go for exercising. In Te Aroa here in Rotorua, we have our beautiful hot pools, so love the hot pools. And just spending time with my partner and looking forward to seeing my son and his partner and my little moko. And we've got a new little moko on the way. So that family time, that partner time is really important. Yeah.
Because, you know, to use another analogy about balls, I know family, whānau, that's the one ball you don't want to drop, because we need to look at that ball like glass. Other balls can be rubber and they bounce back, job, or personal development, or whatever it might be, but the real precious one that we don't want to drop is family, right?
Yeah. Yes, and I just want to, you know, first of all, I'd just like to introduce myself, Kit. You know, I'm called Kevin Hollihu Tapingwa, ko Rua Petropeka Te Maunga, ko Taumarare Te Awa, ko Ngāti Hine Te Hapu, ko Ngāpui Te Iwi, ko Ngā Tokimata Paura Te Waka, ko Kevin Hollihu Tapingwa. I hail from a little place called Tōwai up north, but I was born and raised here in Te Aroa, the sunny part of North Island, as we always say. The Maunga I connect to is Ngongatā Te Maunga, and just want to give tribute to my mum, who passed away a couple of months ago, and so she's going through my own huarahi at the moment in terms of grieving. She was a big part of my journey of self-discovery. She was my friend, she was my mum, but she never judged me. She always provided me with a space, but never enabled me, but always supported me. So, wherever she is, I know that she'll be watching down supporting me and my huarahi. And for those that haven't seen it already, in Marae last year, on the through On Demand, is a documentary of me and my mum, how she supported me through my journey of self-discovery here. So kia ora, Kent. It's a real privilege and honour to be here.
Appreciate you sharing that, and our heartfelt condolences on the loss of your mum. How big a rock was she in your life? Because we're about to unpack your story. How big a rock was your mum?
Kaitiaki. So kaitiaki, you know, in Māori terms, that's the guardian. You know, mum was my rock. Yet there were things that I went through in my early stages. You know, I started using cannabis at 6 years old. You know, I was just a young, smaller than an adolescent. Started my huarahi. Mum and dad were hard workers. Dad was a carpenter. Mum was a nurse. But they loved to drink, you know, and that was part of the culture. And so I was sort of brought into that culture, and I used to like what my brothers and sisters were doing, you know, smoking the taritari, the cannabis over here. So it was about my environment, but mum always provided a clay. Dad was always hard working, and I think that's one of the doctrines or the values that they've instilled in me, to work hard, be loyal to your partner, and create happiness wherever you're going, you know. Mum was big part of different churches. She was connected to a number of different volunteer groups, and she taught me about being kind and being nice to people and loving and caring, and that's one of the things that I'm carrying on, part of her legacy. Yeah. So she was 84 years old. She passed away peacefully in her sleep, but she was a big part of our kaupapa. All of my whānau that were supported in recovery, they all called her Nan. So when Nan walked into our kaupapa, everyone got up, acknowledged her. So yeah, a big a loss for not only me, but our kaupapa and our whānau in recovery.
And you mentioned that she did not enable you. So was that a source of tension at all, that your mum wanted what was best for you, but it took you a little bit longer to figure that out?
Good question, Ken, and I love it, because that's absolutely right. I was so resistant to the support, but it was always that place of loving. Like, there was a bed, there was kai, but there was never any money for me to go and buy any drugs. So she never gave me money or enabled the behavior. So what it means was that when you come home, have a sleep, have a kai, and there will always be a bed for you. Don't bring that stuff inside here. Don't bring your mates around here that are using. You know, obviously I didn't listen a lot of my time, but, you know, I transitioned from a cannabis user for many years, 15 years, and it was easy for me to go into the methamphetamine space, which we know is the most powerful drug in the world. You know, it's made in 150 different ways. There's over 50,000 different chemicals in methamphetamine. You know, it's so cheap. You know, methamphetamine for a kilo, there's 1,000 grams in a kilo, sold from Mexico is $1,000. You know, I mean, on the American market, it's $5,000. But when it gets to little old New Zealand out on our streets, you know, anyone can pop it somewhere in terms of between $50,000 to $100,000. So the monetary is huge. You know, from my own research and my own self-discoveries, I've been clean for 15 years. So researching about what methamphetamine did to my body, the harmful effects that it caused, but also the harmful of self-harm it causes for our people. So I've come to the realization that it's an unconscious suicide attempt. No one knows what they're putting in their body. There's so much self-harm with this methamphetamine. And so that was my journey for many years, and before I ended up in prison for methamphetamine. So I've spent years researching about the harmful effects, but also what it's done to me as a person, and looked at ways that I can support whānau in recovery too. And I'm just so proud of all my staff who have come out of their own struggles, who now are working as practitioners to help others. So having a real lived experience lens while you're studying for that tohu helps to support our whānau who want to inspire to look, be that change. You know, Ngāti Pō, ko te ao marama, from the darkest deck, we become enlightened by the people that we serve in our community.
And you're an extremely well-researched.
I think my mum taught me, yeah.
Sure. Well, I was just going to ask about your time in prison, because I know you're extremely well-researched, you're extremely well-qualified, and you did a truckload of self-discovery and learning. Had it not been for a stint in prison, would you be where you are today?
Good question, kid. Look, as soon as I got arrested, you know, I've been arrested 29 times, thrown into a prison cell, but the day that I got arrested and I was heading to the Parehereere, you know, prison, I knew in my whole ahua had sort of collapsed. You know, I was this person. I was up for 4 days. I'd been up for many weeks on end. And I really believe, Ken, that the Atua, the God Saviour, was put me into that place or with death. Like, honestly, I was knocking on heaven's door. I was, in Māori terms, we call it kahu pō, so the state of addiction, destructive behavior for your family, so cutting core. So I was in that state. So I was dead. So I strongly believe that the Atua of God had given me another chance. So it was either prison or dead. He chose prison for me, and I'm so grateful that I went to prison, because I learned not only about what the system provides for our people, but I've realized now that I needed to go through to prison to learn what I've discovered about myself today. And so we go from kahu pō to toi ora. Toi ora is living well, living prosperous, and looking at what can we do differently in our lives. So there's a big transformative change and hope, you know, hold on, pain end is a big one for people in recovery. So what did prison do? It taught me, you know, the system told me when to eat, the system told me when to sleep. I was institutionalized by the system. And so when I came out of prison, the first 5 days, I was back into the same environment. So research shows the first 5 days of someone coming out of prison is at risk of going back to the same environment. I think I was like day six. And I remember my mum saying to me, don't you go down the street there. There's those people down there. That's how he spoke to me. And I did. I went down that street. I seen those people, the exact same people mum told me not to see. And I went back into a fully blown meth addiction for at least another 12 months. And that's when I found myself massive behaviours. I smashed into an 80-wheeler truck. I wrecked the trail off. I smashed into another truck. All I could think about was my meth. So the desire to use me was stronger than the desire to live. And people always ask me, what was the turning point for you? And when I first used to get asked, I was thinking, oh, geez, how do I answer this? And I remember one day, Mum said to me, you need to clean up. What are you going to do? And I said, I'll hand myself in, because I started getting arrested for different behaviors associated to my addiction. Around a month, I said, I'm going to hand myself in. So we went down to the police station and they said, thank God that you handed yourself in, Kevin. You were one day out of being in police 37, and they had this photo of me. Holy heck. You might see it on Google. It is pretty horrendous. Anyway, Mum cried and she said, look, I'm so glad we're doing this. Literally when I got bail, there was a guy that came into my mum's driveway. He ran me over, speeding up the driveway. I ricocheted off. He drove out. I looked back and there's my mum standing there. She said, I need you to call the police. I said, look, at its state, Nakma. He said, well, if you don't, I will. And then she put it to me, okay, I could have been dead. And I'm like, oh, that was a big one for me. Yeah, so that was a turning point. When we think about turning points, there was probably one of the biggest turning points in my life then. And from there, sat on my mum's couch, I healed, I disassociated myself to people, and then I started studying and started my social work certificate, social work degree. And that's been my healing space to self-discover who I am as a person. Not using it in a way to heal, but using it in a way to inspire, to look at different things and something positive in my life. Yeah.
really appreciate the honesty and the vulnerability, Kevin. And you're not the first person I've heard talk about wanting the methamphetamine more than your own health, your own well-being, essentially your own life. When you are in the grip of the addiction,
yes,
can you describe for us in as much detail as you would please what it is actually like?
You are, honestly, your whole body changes. There's a different person. So when I look at people now who are using, you know, their jaws going off, their eyes are risen, they're at it. They're having what I call this out-of-body experience. Like, I would probably sleep 6 hours a month. By September, I'll be planning to sleep at least 2 days till Christmas, because the methamphetamine, you know, increases 1,200 of units of dopamine flushing through your body. You're having this massive, your whole body's like on fire from the most powerful drug, you know. Something like sex or food, you know, increases like 50 units of dopamine. You're having this massive amount of euphoria flushing through your body. And so that was me, this whole euphoria of energy, of being up for days and traveling around, and you're very talkative and this grandiosis. And honestly, the out-of-body experiences that I was having, it took me right into these like psychosis, you know, I was hearing things, I was seeing things. As I was withdrawing from methamphetamine, my pores were open of this massive amount of chemicals coming out of me. So I was having symptoms of depression, you know, low mood, anxieties. But formally they weren't diagnosed. You know, I was unwell. I was super unwell by the most powerful drug that I thought was my friend at the time, you know.
Yeah, it makes sense, doesn't it, with the release of dopamine? I mean, there's that dopamine seesaw. The higher you go, presumably the lower you need. The body is and the brain is wanting to bring you crashing back down to normality. And so what is it then about chasing the next hit? Because I want to feel good again. I don't want to feel like a bag of shit.
That's it, Ken. And that's totally right. So that euphoria after having like one or two puffs of methamphetamine, so I was smoking it throughout a pipe. You know, the high is about 3 minutes, 4 minutes, and then you have another puff, you know, 4 minutes, 5 minutes, and then after about half an hour, you know, you've had all these sort of inhaling all this meth, and you know, it lasts for an hour, 24 hours, but the high, you know, 1,275 units of dopamine. When you're coming down, the brain needs to get rid of all the toxicity, and it vacuums it out. You know, it needs to vacuum it out so your body can recover. I never allowed my body to recover. You know, it was, mum would talk to me and my brain was sort of like on fire. Like I couldn't make sense. I couldn't talk. I couldn't function. I'd wave my hands in the air. I was very vocal. You know, I'd drive up someone's driveway thinking I was at home, but the psychosis had kicked in because I was seeing things. So when we look at the social harm this methamphetamine is causing, these are what the Alfano are going through. You know, that they're having hallucinating thoughts, they're driving up the road and having these massive accidents like I did, you know, and people died from it. I'm just so grateful to be here and tell my story again.
And we appreciate you sharing your story too. And I'd love to know, how far into your journey of sobriety did you think, geez, man, I've got this, I'm going to be okay?
Yeah. Because cannabis was a big one for me growing up. It was a real, you know, from a young age. So what I did is someone told me that it was 21 days to break a habit, 21 days to make a habit. And literally, I applied that doctrine to my cannabis use. And I gave up cannabis, and by day 18, I was having these pop flushes, and I'm thinking, wow. And by 21, literally, I never wanted to smoke again. I haven't smoked for 25 years, cannabis. Methamphetamine, I applied those same principles. However, I had so much time to reflect on the destructive behavior that I had caused. I was literally going back into prison again or knocking on death's door. And so I really had to make some choices. Again, the person that was there was my kaitiati, my mum, and said to me, literally, that's what you said to me, Clint. You've got a brain, now use it. I'm like, what do you mean? She goes, go and get some study. You've been helping all these people with methamphetamine all these years. Now start helping people in social work. So literally that's what I did. I just transferred all these skills that I had in my meth addiction into positive lives. You know, they talk about people, places and things, you know. Now I just changed all that narrative into positive people, positive places and positive things that I connect to daily. And one of the things that works for me, and I still do it religiously, is gratitude. Three things that I'm grateful for each morning. Two things that I'm grateful that I don't have now. I don't say I want a Tesla because I still haven't got a Tesla kit, or Ferrari. But two things that I'm grateful that I don't have, like having a massive day today. I knew that I was meeting you today again, so I was like, can't wait to meet Ken. I'm having a grateful day, you know, so simple thing, you know. One of the things that we do too much of is that when we expect too much, it brings it out disappointment. So it's about being grateful. And in Māori terms, it's about giving it a mihi each day, each part of the day, you know, acknowledge it, feel it, and actually implement it. Yeah, so I do that daily. It's part of my rituals, Ken, and it makes me uplift because I'm able to share that into my own therapy, into my own practice, own groups, all of the models and things that people taught me while I was going through my active addiction, and then I've gone to studies and I've learned about them. I apply those and now I'm able to teach them. Yeah, it's amazing.
To be fair, no one's really wanting to buy a Tesla at the moment.
Yeah.
Did you feel, Kevin, did you feel that the system wanted you to succeed?
No, good question. I've got it, did it, like, when I came out of prison, I was still institutionalization, you know. I was waiting for the officer to come around at every hour to put the torch into my bedroom. So I would block off my windows. I would close my door. Mum would come in the next one, open them up, couldn't understand what I was going through. And I didn't realize, and I'm not going to say just, I did 2.5 years of prison. You know, these guys that have done 10 years, 20, you know, at the institutionalized, you know, I did 2.5 years and I was feeling like this. And I felt really isolated and discriminated by society because as soon as I got out of prison, I had to go into WINS and, you know, prior to WINS. And I had massive anxieties because all the people that were there, I couldn't walk up the street. I was waiting for the officer to, you know, walk me up the street. So those are the things around institutionalism. But today, you know, I'm able to be more of aware of what I went through to where I am today.
Tell us about the work. I know one of your long-term ambitions was to get into prisons and run some rehab programs and just be empathetic to people who had gone through the same path as yourself. Tell us about the work that you're doing.
Oh, thanks, Kit. You know, when I got released from prison, it was on February 1st, 2009, and of course my mum was there to pick me up, and the officer was walking me down this long driveway, you know, unlocking the door, and he said to me, Kevin, you won't be back. And I said, oh, thank you. And he goes, no, the majority of the people I let out each week, I always tell them, you'll be back, and sure enough, they're back. But I can tell you, Kevin, you won't be back. And I said, oh, Piotr Matua, I am going to come back then. I'm going to run a AOD program here one day. So, you know, these light bulb moments going off. You know, when I was in prison, I did a lot of therapy, I did a lot of programs, and I challenged the programs. I challenged the psychologists in there, and I didn't know why I was doing that. And I was, you know, it was some of my behaviors that I was still hadn't worked on. But I realized that those were light bulb moments going on for me. And I thought, he's a psychologist, he's a counsellor. Man, they have no lived experience, but they have these flash university sort of certificates, and they're trying to help me or support me. Imagine if my lived experience, and I had one of these certificates, like I went to university. So there was a light bulb moment going for me. One day, with my lived experience, if I go back to university, I can come back to the prison and work with our men. And, yeah, fortunate enough throughout my work and what I've been doing, I've been able to do some of that work in the prisons. You know, we do AVL sessions with guys in prison, so that audio video links. I work with some of the men to do some of the AOD assessments. I've been into the prisons and worked doing some of the AOD programs, the alcohol and drug programs. You know, I always talk about my lived experience. I talk about me being in prison, and that captures them. They relate to that, you know, and I always tell them, I always take recovery so seriously. I've got to have 2 feet in. But that actually helps the men to go far out, Kevin. If you can do it, I can do it. And so that's how I've been able to navigate myself back into the prison and work with them. And some of the practitioners I've been working with in there are fantastic. Even the prison guards, the case managers, you know, even them, they go, wow. There is hope. We've been working with these men for a long time, and now someone like you, Kev, you know, is providing us hope. So I always want our men who are coming out of prison to come and do some studies with me and apply themselves to our program, and then take them back into prison as mentors, you know, to work with the men. That's really my strong ambition, and have a number of mentors working with the men in prison who have been to prison, you know. And I think there's been a big shift from Arapaitama corrections to maybe look at some of that, you know, especially if they're letting me back into the prison again, you know, I've got a criminal record as long as both our arms.
Well, I mean, what you've just described there is this enormously powerful ripple effect and influence that one man is able to have, right?
Yes, again, a lot of support, though. You know, yep. So I'll tell you a little story. There's a policeman. When I come out of prison, it was my destiny to work with the police that arrested me. And when I was doing my social work degree, there was a detective that came to our courts, and he goes, Kevin, will you come with me and do presentations with me? I'm like, oh, wow. Are you sure? He goes, yeah, I talk about methadone. You'll be great. He's seen an opportunity in me, and I was so grateful. So we went around to the different workplaces and did presentation. Then I thought, oh, can I talk to your boss? He goes, yep, go and talk to him. And I knocked on his door and I said, hey, I want to start working with you. And he goes, oh no, he brought methamphetamine, don't peel. What are you doing here? And I said, no, I've got a social work degree. And he goes, oh, okay. Shit, tell me more about yourself. And so we had these, meetings, and, one of them arrested me many years ago, and now he's a board. He's on my board. He's one of my cultural advisors on my board. I've got him on speed dial, Ken. I never thought I'd have a policeman on speed dial. But they supported me in our programs here in Tauranga. It's been amazing, and I have to give credit to the police, actually. They're one of the biggest organizations that actually wrapped their arms around me and said, Kev, what do you want? What do you need? And also corrections had done the same. You know, we've been running programs in the marais. The police have been there. First of all, it started off with a little bit of poha for me. Then they looked at funding. Then Arapaitama got some funding because they thought, wow, there's real value in this program. The elders of Te Aroha mandated the program, so then we're able to continue the program. The 2016, we've been running like Wānanga harm reduction programs here in Te Aroha and our marae. And then in 2018, we started our Rōpū breach here in Te Aroha at the church, local churches, because we start them up in local churches because whenever our pāna attend them, we know they're not going to get a bit naughty in there, and you know, God's willing, they're there. Not saying that we're religious or anything. We just find that churches open up their spaces for us and allow us to run our groups in the way that we run them. And it's really beautiful, and great credit to my staff now who run the programs.
Sometimes life throws up these scarcely believable scenarios. Have you spoken to the policeman on speed dial and said, hey man, have you actually stopped and thought about where both of us are today and the relationship we have now compared to all of those years ago?
I'll constantly get where, honestly, we remind ourselves of that. You know, the first time he said, okay, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to go around to all the marais and do a presentation. And I said, but I don't have any petrol. And I don't, you know, I've got an old car. And he goes, I'll pick you up. And honestly, Kevin, he picked me up on the main street in Tauruwa in the detective car. Well, my old language, I used to call it a D car. And I'm like, I could see it a mile back. And I'm like, oh, no, that's not him, is it? And he turns up and he goes, there you go, mate, jump in. We're off to Taupo or wherever we're going. And I said, I really can't get in here. And he goes, what do you mean, mate? And I said, I've got massive anxieties to get in this police car. I've been in here so many times with handcuffs. I can't get in this car. I won't tell you what he said on camera, though, Ken. He did say in terms, brim, 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 get in the car or I'll put the handcuffs back on you. And so I went into the back seat and he goes, what are you doing, mate? Get in the front seat. I said, hey, that's where the nuts go. You know, so, yeah, honestly, we've been traveling around and now I asked him for the keys, but he's never given me the keys to drive the police car. But honestly, Ken, they have been so supportive. So they would bring like the neph bags. They would bring, methamphetamine pipes with methamphetamine still in them. They would bring some of the cooking gears to manufacture methamphetamine. And then we would go around to the different marais and we would present what it looks like, how it's presented. And then pass around the pipes, you know, and some of our kaumatu and kroa, even my mum, said, what do you do with this boy? And you put it to your mouth, mum, and he'd like this. She'd go, oh, there's education. And I get random phone calls by some of the kaumatu and kroa after the presentation saying, boy, I found some of those pipes in my moko's room and I kicked them out. Oh, do you want a fire? We don't kick them out. We support them. But that was a realization that we were making a difference. We were educating our kaumatu, our kroa. And one of the things that we don't talk enough about is how do we protect, like my mum, our pākeke, our elders, because they're ending up with their mokopunas, their grandchildren, and had no idea what this pee stuff looks like. That's what they always say to me, pee, yeah. So, yeah, the policeman, and we've been developing this relationship. Him and I still meet once a month. We had wānanga. He presents about what the police are doing. Corrections are there, and it's on the marae, and whānau come in and they go, oh, I feel pretty safe being on the marae, and oh no, there's the police, oh no, there's corrections, oh, there's this guy Kevin, he's talking about his lived experience. Actually, I feel quite safe here, and then people start opening up, and now my staff are being able to share their lived experience, what they're doing, and we really are making these hope for our whānau in our community, you know. We run online Zoom sessions on a Monday, Friday, Rōpū groups on a Wednesday and a Friday. And we're seeing anywhere between 20 and 50 people per week. And are we funded for that? No. Do we do it out of the love and passion we have? Absolutely. Is there funding we can apply for? Absolutely. And I just want to thank some of the community initiatives that we've been able to apply for some of the funding, you know, to fund us for some coffee, some teas and some reed for the churches and the marais has been something magical, Ken, and I'm really, really am grateful.
You're doing some amazing work. If for the people that you talk to that are still in the grip of a meth addiction or a pee addiction, what's the biggest obstacle they face between where they are now and where they would like to be with their lives?
Yeah, kia ora. I think if you look at the four pillars of recovery, so physical needs, home, relationships at home, and then community connection, you know, physical needs, you know. So someone doesn't just have a full-on blown meth addiction. There's a physical relapse, an emotional relapse. There's something before that relapse, right? So what we try to do is allow our whānau to think about their physical needs. What are the things that they need to ensure they have food, nutrition, water, and sleep is a really important thing. And then home. Do they have a safe home? Do they have a warm home? Because generally, those two aspects of recovery are missing. People don't, like me, didn't have enough tools to self-regulate my meth addiction or my anticipation on wanting to use. And that's part of the physical well-being. My home was always good, like it was with mum, but But when I was a fully blown meth addict or into methamphetamine in my highest times, I actually become homeless. I actually was living in my car. I was living on the, I lived in my car in the different car parks in Auckland. And that was something that I needed to work on. My home, relationships, you know, I didn't have a relationship with some of the key people that were in my life at that time. And I didn't have community connections. And so those are the four pillars that we work with in recovery, using Te Pareka Pawha holistic approach, you know, the hine nuttall, the mind, whānau pro-social groups or relationships, kinana, looking after yourself, and the wairua, the values and beliefs. And those are the things that I look at daily. But yeah, the four pillars, when whānau don't have good physical health, when they don't have a good home environment, when they don't have those relationships at home, and or when they don't have good community connections. But they can start rebuilding those. So if I looked the other way, I started building good community connections, started having good connections at home, started looking at for a safe home, and then I worked on my physical needs. So those are some of the things. So poverty is a big one, tent, environment, people's mental health, distress and disorder is a big one, where people use harder substances to suppress and minimize the pain or trauma. Trauma is a big one. As we know, Mate Gabe talks about trauma as wound. You know, it's not about the actual event. It's about what the event is doing to you, or the trauma and how you carry that wound. And so, you know, there's been many wounds that I've had to carry, but rediscover and know who I am to help heal.
You've spoken a lot about gratitude with us. Last question, what are you most hopeful for?
Oh, I'm most hopeful for an Aotearoa drug-free. You know, that we look at looking at the demand as opposed to the supply. We provide more programs in our community so people can feel well, supported. You know, there's only about 9 residential treatment facilities here in New Zealand, and I think a lot of them aren't funded as well as they could be. I would love to see a marae-based programs for our people to give hope to them. I would like to see less people in our prisons. Our prison population has risen. But I would like to see more programs available, not only for rangatahi, not only for whānau, but also for our pākeke. You know, they hold the mākauranga, the wisdom and knowledge for us to pass down onto us, like my mum did, and installed some of the doctrines for me to live a prosperous life.
We really hope that you live a prosperous life, Kevin, and appreciate your time on Take It From Us. Thanks for sharing your story.
Thank you.
Take It From Us is produced by Karen Murphy, and I am your host, Kent Johns. Please get in touch with us on Facebook. We'd love to hear from you.
You're listening to Take It From Us. My story, your story, our story.
Your language on planetaudio.org.nz.
Whether you call it Aotearoa, New Zealand, New Zealand, or Nova Zelandia, it's worth knowing the history of the place most of us call home. Starting 100 million years ago and bringing us right through to modern day, the Aotearoa History Show explores some of the forces that have shaped this land and its people, from the geographical to the social and political. Produced by RNZ, the Aotearoa History Show airs here on 104.6 Planet FM every Monday at 2:35 p.m. And you can hear the full series anytime online by visiting the series and podcasts page at rnz.co.nz or using your favourite podcasting app.
Need a break? Join Mariska and Kara for Two Sugars, Conversations Over Coffee, Wednesday afternoons at 3:55 on 104.6 Planet FM. Or listen anytime, planetaudio.org.nz/Two Sugars.
the west coast.
It has beautiful scenery. The harbour is absolutely amazing.
Good weather, good people, and I like it.
My favourite thing about Auckland is the amazing views that I get when